Okay, I'm going to play that at the end rather than the beginning. Okay? Okay, can you all hear me? Okay, let's review real quick, and then we're going to do, I'm going to give you some examples of what I call Jesus' apologetics, his method of responding to an adversary. And we might do a little role-playing here, and maybe I could play the devil's advocate, and you could play Jesus and try to respond to my stubbornness or my adversarial tone, okay? Let me go through a quick overview. The lesson of the Polar Express is ideas are directional. Ideas always take you somewhere. There is no idea that just lies fallow and does nothing. Every idea has an end. A good idea will have a good end. A bad idea will have a bad end. History proves that over and over again. Okay? I've said repeatedly that the historical nightmares, at least in contemporary times, can all be tracked back to a lousy idea. Okay? Again, I talked about Stalin, we talked about Hitler, we talked about Pol Pot, we talked about Robespierre and the French Revolution, we talked about Mao and the Cultural Revolution. Every bad idea will have a bad end, and good ideas will have a good end. My argument is ideas are directional. It does matter what train you get on. It does matter what train you get on. And if you want to argue differently, then think of the movie Schindler's List, and if you will, remember the scene where the train on a snow-laden German hill with the black forest in the distance, and the train is chugging across this wintry landscape with the steam puffing from its smokestack. And behind the train are several boxcars. And you can hear the whistle off in the distance. And as the train chugs along, it passes children playing in the snow. And if you remember the scene, some of the children are looking up at the boxcars, which have what in them? Jews. The Jews are looking out of the cracks in the boxcar at the children playing in the snow, and some of the children are looking up and mocking the Jews, and one little boy looks up and does this. And you see it in slow motion, and they do it. They go back and they repeat it again, and the little boy does this, because the little boy knows where the Jews are heading. The Jews don't know yet. They're not sure if they're heading to freedom or if they're heading someplace else. And then that train chugs into a dark, wintry night through the gates of Auschwitz. And you see snow falling from the sky on the train. But it's not snow, is it? What is it? It's ashes coming from the smokestacks, the furnaces of Auschwitz. Now, who among you wants to look at those Jews and say, you know, the thing about trains is this. It doesn't matter where they're going. It just matters that you get on one. You see, the bad idea of value-neutral arguments is ludicrous, and it's very dangerous. It's especially dangerous for Jews in that movie. Okay? Ideas are directional. They always lead somewhere. Okay? The other idea that we've talked about is the lesson of four. Basically, what I'm trying to encourage you to do with those examples is to put some arrows in your quiver, and I gave you three sets of four as examples of those arrows. We talked about worldview and the four components of a worldview. It's important to establish the origin, the nature, the responsibility, and the redemption of humanity as a basis for your worldview argument. Okay? Talked about the quadrilateral and the balance that it represents in evaluating an argument. Okay? And then we talked about the four that are particular to me that we've embraced at Oklahoma Wesleyan University, and those are primacy of Christ, priority of Scripture, the pursuit of truth, and the practice of wisdom. The first two are probably obvious for this group because Jesus is the Son of God, the Bible is the Word of God. The second two, I would argue, aren't all that obvious to any Christian group today because they presuppose truth as a revelation of God versus a construct of man, which is directly opposed to our postmodern culture. And those are fighting words for many people today to say that truth is revelational, truth is objective, truth is absolute, truth is beyond your opinion, truth is given from above, it's not created from below. Those are fighting words within the academy, and those are fighting words within most neighborhoods, and even some churches. We talked about that. And then finally, the practice of wisdom. Yes, go ahead.
There are professors who have endorsed some variation of truth, and they have subsequently
You know, I wrote a paper a couple years ago. It was posted in Chuck Colson's Breakpoint magazine, as well as a couple other places. And it was, the title of it, bear with me now, the title of it was Why I'm a Liberal and Other Conservative Ideas. Why I'm a Liberal and Other Conservative Ideas. And my argument was this: I'm more liberal. And you've been with me for a couple hours now, and you know that in contemporary definitions, I'm probably not. You're probably thinking, what's he talking about? I haven't spent 2 hours with a liberal. But really, I am, and I'm going to argue so are you. We are more liberal than the academic that works with you or works with me. Here's why. What's the root word of liberal? It's the same as liberty. Liberation. If you're a liberal, you should stand for liberty, right? If you're a liberal, you believe in liberation. If you're a liberal, you believe in justice and equality. You believe in these things. You fight for these things. Well, I'm more liberal than most of my progressive academic partners because I have confidence in the truth being the judge of the debate or the argument, as opposed to me or you. Therefore, the debate and the argument can be very rigorous, and any idea can be put on the table. I don't care what idea you want to put on the table, because I'm not the judge, nor are you. Truth is. Now, if you believe that, and you really want liberal discussion that's liberating and brings justice, then why would you want to exclude any idea from the discussion? I don't. If you want to talk about intelligent design versus evolution, let's put them both on the table and see which one is stronger. But in the academy today, do they want to put intelligent design on the table? Absolutely not. In fact, in the state of Kansas, it's been legislated out of the classroom. Okay?
After having been legislated into the classroom.
Right.
Which is a direct reversal.
So why is this conservative guy being branded as anti-intellectual when I'm the one that wants to put all the ideas on the table so that we can debate them thoroughly, aggressively, and come to a logical conclusion? I'm not the one saying you can't put that idea on the table. It's the quote-unquote liberal that is. My point is this. The contemporary liberal agenda is a closed-minded agenda, whereas you as conservatives, me as a conservative that believes in the conserving the time-tested things that have been given to us, conserving a tree, conserving a whale, conserving an owl, conserving an idea. Because the conservation of these things has a higher value than my definition of them. That's the most liberating idea in the room. Global warming. Global warming today is becoming a closed conversation. If you want to discuss climate change and the truth or lack thereof for global temperature, or if you want to admit that global warming may be taking place because statistically you've seen enough evidence to say, well, okay, yeah, the temperature has increased by this amount over the last 40 years of measurement. But if you want to say, as an economist, I want to discuss the consequences of implementing some of our proposed actions, because if we implement all the policies of Al Gore, then there will be a consequence to the poor of the world because the economy will change, food supplies will be limited, food will cost more, and therefore people in the third world will die of starvation. There's an economist in the Netherlands right now that's making that argument, and no one will listen to him. Well, what kind of liberal debate is that? You follow me? I am more liberal than your buddies that work with you that claim to be liberal because I want to have the conversation. And I have confidence that there's a judge beyond you and me that can determine the strength of the debate. That's liberating. Okay? So don't be afraid. That's perhaps a good segue to what we're going to talk about now. Don't be afraid of the power of your idea. You have a very strong idea. Your idea actually will give more liberty, will provide a greater standard of tolerance, will allow all ideas to be discussed within the context of civility, more so than your adversary's idea. I firmly believe that, yes.
When you use the term academy, what group of people are you?
I'm referring to the university. I'm referring to the educational community. I'm referring to the academics of our culture. I would include secondary education and elementary education in that too, but primarily my experience is university, so it's my personal experience that I'm referring to there. Okay? Some would use the terminology intellectual elites, the ivory tower folks that think, now I'm starting to critique my own profession. The ivory tower is a very arrogant place. It's very political. It's very arrogant. I mean, stop and think about it. In fact, there's an old college president that took me aside when I was starting my career back when I was 21 years old. He took me out to lunch at a Greasy Spoon in southern Michigan, and we sat down to have a Coney dog together. And I'm still not sure why he took me under his wing. Maybe he saw something in my future that I wasn't aware of yet. But anyway, I remember him looking across the table at me over Coney dogs. His name was Woody Vowler. And he said, Everett, I want to tell you something. Faculty are those who think otherwise. That's all he said? We had our Coney dog. Faculty are those who think otherwise. There's a lot of wisdom in that. The academy is full of a lot of very bright people who are very capable intellectually. And I've got a good friend that wrote a paper called The Pathology of the Intellect. And it was basically he's an incredibly bright guy. And it was his own personal testimony where he was speaking against his own temptations, his own sin. And that is, our intellect can be sick. We can become sick in our own righteousness. And that's, so when I poke on the academy, I'm poking at myself, I'm poking at my own industry, because I really do think that college and university professors, and I think that some of the high school teachers and whatnot, I think the teaching profession, by and large, why does Scripture challenge teachers as aggressively as anybody else? Remember what Jesus said about teachers? You be careful. Huh? What's that? Exactly, because you're held to a high standard, if not a higher standard, than some other professions. And you might as well have a millstone tied around your neck and be cast in the sea if you lead people astray. I mean, that's a pretty damning critique of what I do and what some of you do. We've got to be careful. The pathology of the intellect really can weave its way into our heart and soul. Okay, how did Jesus handle people? I think I have made a lot of mistakes in my desire to debate. I love to win an argument. You do too, don't you? We all love to win the argument. But look at how Jesus handled people that hated him, hated his ideas, and didn't want to hear what he had to say. Okay? I'm going to suggest that his style included a couple things. First, I don't think Jesus argued very much. What did he do when they came to him and said, "Who should we pay taxes to?" What did he do? Exactly. You're both right. He asked a question. Then what did he do? He asked the question and he shut up. He let them talk. And then he responded to their words. What's that? Oh, whatever. What did he do when they brought the prostitute to him? What? He
knelt down and drew it and didn't say anything.
What did he do when they brought the prostitute to him and they wanted to stone her? What did he do?
He knelt down and dribbled in the sand.
And then what did he say?
Who's ever justified to throw the stone, throw it.
Who of you is without sin? He asked a question. So what did he do when they brought when they said, "Who should we pay taxes to?" He asked them a question. He shut up. And then he responded to their words. What did he do when they brought the prostitute to him? He asked them a question. He shut up, and then he responded to to their actions or their words. Okay, let me give you another one. They came to him and they asked, "Good teacher, what should we do about X, Y, and Z?" What did he do?
Why do you call me good?
He asked a question, he shut up, and he responded to their words. You get my point? It's obvious. I don't think Jesus argued a lot. Now, in every one of those situations I just brought to your attention, the people coming to him were trying to manipulate him, and they were trying to trap him. They disagreed with his worldview. He knew it. They were adversaries. In our lives today, when we've got somebody that disagrees with our worldview, and they're our adversaries, maybe we should respond as Jesus responded. Maybe just asking a question and being quiet is the right thing to do.
That's a valid point. I remember watching this thing on Ron Wood's TV that you guys all know about, taking the kids to ATF and all the requirements, the firearms. And always before those, they go, or before the major rally, the ones that they do in Detroit and San Francisco and everything, they will have a rally on the front of the court, yard steps, and it's basically kind of an anti-media thing because of how the media has corrupted our generation. The rally. They protest the media, and then they have people that come and protest them. And one of the protesters that was protesting them was arguing with one of the girls that was, you know, "Oh, well, we don't want you to take away our rights to watch whatever we wanted to watch, and we don't want this, we don't want our freedoms threatened." And she, rather than, you know, arguing with him and saying, "We're not threatening your freedom," she says, "Well, do you feel threatened?" And he's like, "We just don't want you to take away." I mean, he didn't answer her question, but she defused his argument just by a single word. I mean, "Do you feel threatened? Or do you feel like we're threatening you?" And that was her response, too, was to just ask a question. I mean, to be a little bit more direct to him.
I really think this is critical here. Let me, and it's an excellent example. I think asking a question and being quiet is probably the most powerful thing you can do, because it demonstrates that you listened. You're listening to the other person, so you're showing them respect. And rather than trying to browbeat them with the strength of your argument, you're asking them to explain how they really feel. Now, did Jesus know the weakness of their argument? Absolutely. Did he know that his question would corner them? Absolutely. But he didn't have to try to embarrass them with his words. He knew that their own response was going to be embarrassing enough, because their idea was bad. Their idea was shallow. It held no water. I don't think we need to do a lot of arguing, folks, because the truth will argue for us. We just need to ask the logical question. So I think one of the first components of good apologetics is ask a question and be quiet. Just ask a question and be quiet. The second is don't be intimidated. Jesus was never intimidated. They don't know what they're talking about. Remember that. Jesus was never intimidated. So in the first context, he always asked a question, and he asked the question with confidence and simplicity because he wasn't intimidated. He didn't need to talk a lot. I remember when I started my profession in education, I was hired as a fundraiser at my alma mater. And my job was to go out and ask you people for money. And I didn't like it. I felt intimidated. And there was a consultant that was hired from Milwaukee to come in and teach us young kids that were in brand new fundraisers how to do it. And I'll never forget what this guy said. He said, "A good fundraiser does this. He asks for the gift, and you shut up. Don't say anything." And then he said, "Because the next person who talks loses." There's a lot of wisdom in that. Because as a young 21-year-old salesman who was trying to ask for gifts for my alma mater. What's the temptation? There's anxiety. The conversation isn't one I want to have. I'm intimidated. So I ask you for a gift. Would you give me $500 for Oklahoma Wesleyan University? And before I even allow you to answer, what do? I fill the void with words because I'm uncomfortable. I don't like the silence.
What?
Yeah. And that, but like this consultant said, he said, be quiet, because the next one who talks loses. In other words, if you're quiet long enough and the donor speaks first, you'll probably get a gift. I think the same thing's true in the way Jesus handled people. He asked a question and he wasn't intimidated, so he let silence play to his advantage. He knew that his adversaries really didn't know what they were talking about. He knew his idea was stronger. He wasn't intimidated. The third one is be liberal. Okay? Be liberal. Ask questions. Don't be intimidated. Be liberal. And what did I just tell you about my definition of being liberal? Liberal is having confidence in the truth. Trust the truth. Put all the ideas on the table. You know, whose face is on this coin? Well, let's talk about it. Let's see whose face is on the coin. Is it God's, or is it yours, or is it mine, or is it Caesar's? You tell me. I'm going to trust the truth of this argument. Who of you is without sin? Let's let the truth be the judge. I can have confidence in the truth. Okay. Ask questions, be quiet, don't be intimidated, and be liberal. Trust the truth. Put all ideas on the table, because the truth will win. You don't have to win. The truth will. An example here would be in the intelligent design debate, in my opinion, or the global warming debate, in my opinion. Put the ideas on the table. Let the truth win. Sexuality. Put the ideas on the table. I think we can win any debate on sexuality if we put all the ideas on the table, the consequences of those ideas. Nobody in their right mind can argue that a liberal view of sexuality, contemporary liberal view of sexuality, is healthy. They can't. They can't. You've got to acknowledge the consequences of breaking those rules. Okay, next component, tell stories. Jesus always told stories. He did not argue. He told a story. So he asked the question, he was quiet, and he also would tell a story periodically. And they were very simple stories. They were children's stories. Remember the KISS, KISS principle? Remember what it means? Keep it simple, stupid.
Yeah.
Okay? Tell a story and keep it simple, stupid, because those simple stories will win. Parables, anecdotes, speak to the heart as much as you're speaking to the head. Okay, I'm repeating myself here. I'm going to keep going. I want you to remember these. Ask a question. Don't be intimidated. Be liberal. And tell stories. And then, when you're ready to fight, be ready to die. If it's worth fighting for, it's worth dying for. In other words, this is a point of conviction, folks. It's not something that you are weak-kneed about. And if the consequences are negative for you holding to your view, and if you get nailed to a cross at the end of the debate, so be it. So be it. It's not the end of the world. Is it? It's not the end of things. So if you lose by earthly standards, so what? You haven't lost in terms of eternity. Jesus said, "Today the law is fulfilled in your midst." He walked into the temple and offended the money changers. He called people a brood of vipers, whitewashed tombs with dead, rotting bones therein. He was very firm when he needed to be, and he was ready to die for that firmness. I want you to watch something with me here.
There's no other way for the women and children to get out of the caves. Is there no other way?
There is one passage. It leads into the mountains. But they will not get far. The Uruk-hai are too many.
Send word for the women and children to make for the mountain pass and barricade the entrance.
So much death. What can men do against such reckless hate?
Ride out with me. Ride out and meet them.
For death and glory.
For Rohan. For your people.
The sun is rising.
My coming at first light on the fifth day. At dawn, look to the east.
Yes. Yes. The horn of Helm Hammerhand shall sound in the deep. One last time. Yes!
This be the hour when we draw swords together.
Fell deeds awake.
Now for wrath, now for ruin, and the red dawn.
I feel like our adversaries are just as ugly as the Uruk-hai. I mean, it's just grotesque, isn't it? You can just feel the anger and the hatred toward a Christian idea. And the troops are gathering against Christ. The troops are gathering against the Christian worldview. The troops are out there opposing us. And it's not pretty. And almost like the king said, what can man do against such reckless hate? Don't you feel that way sometimes? But what was the answer? The answer was, ride out with me. Ride out with me. Even though the challenge is overwhelming, even though we will likely die in the battle, let's fight for death and for glory. And as they go out into the battle, against all odds, into the ugliest situation imaginable that Tolkien can paint for us, it even sounds bad, doesn't it? You can almost smell it in the movie, the evil. They look up on the hill, and what do they see? They see the Christ figure on the white horse in the eastern sky. The point is, don't be intimidated because you can't lose. Why does worldview matter? Why should you care? It's because ideas have consequence. They will lead you in some direction. Why should you engage in the battle? Because it's your responsibility. You have to. You're called upon by God to practice wisdom, to practice holy life, to stand for what's right, to proclaim what's true. Should you do it with the ugly face of the Orichai or try to just mimic the culture that you're in? No, they're better at it than you are. Don't play by their rules. They are pretty good. If you try to play by Satan's rules, you will lose. He's better at it than you are. If you try to play by the rules of being angry, red-faced, ugly, hateful, yelling louder, and defeating through a strength of your argument, you will likely lose because you're employing Satan's tools and he's better at being ugly than you are. But you can't lose by looking to Christ, regardless of how overwhelming it may seem. The simplicity of Jesus' apologetics, I think, is just an overwhelming example on how we should behave in our daily life, in the church, in our culture, in our neighborhood, in our company, in our school, in our Sunday school class, in our family, with family members that may not agree with us. I'd like to give you a couple examples, and I have had tons of failures, guys, when it comes to apologetics. And we could, but you're not here to hear about failures, you're here to hear about a success or two along the way. So I don't want to paint the picture like I have batted 100%, because I surely have not. But a couple examples where I think through God's grace, I set my ego aside and my fear aside and the intimidation aside, and I kept it simple, stupid, and I just had enough common sense at the moment to just ask a logical question and let the individual fall into his own trap and thus be rescued by God's grace and not my argument. One is with my dad. My dad was not a Christian his entire life. My dad had no use for Christianity. He had a good life. He was a good man. He lived a moral life. He provided for the family. He was a blue-collar truck driver. He took care of us well. But don't talk to him about faith. And I remember at the end of, when my dad was 55, after I'd prayed for him for many years, but I had no faith in my prayers. This one, you know, I pray because I have to, but there's no way my dad will ever become a Christian. That's what I thought. My dad went into the hospital for heart surgery when he was 55, and I stumbled and bumbled into his room, and I felt this overwhelming conviction that I have to talk to him because he's my dad, and he may die, so I don't want to have the guilt of not sharing Christ with him if he dies, so I've got to share my apologetic and talk about my worldview with my dad. Darn it. So, rather than trying to argue with him, through God's grace, I just said, "Dad, do you want to talk about your faith?" I ask a question. And I shut up. And there was silence in the room while he was laying in his hospital bed. And he said, "Well, yeah, I guess," which shocked me. So it's probably through shock that I kept my mouth shut, because I had no idea that that would come. But then he said this. He said, "You know, it's not Christianity that I have trouble with. It's those Christians." So by asking a question and then by keeping my mouth shut, I let my dad speak and basically set his own trap. Remember, the next person that talks loses? And then I said just the simple thing to my dad. I said, "Well, maybe it's time that you stopped looking at Christians and you started looking at Christ." And guys, I didn't need to memorize C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity. I didn't have to have all of the Gospel of John memorized. I didn't have to have anything but those two simple statements. "Do you want to talk about your faith?" I shut up, I let him set his own trap, and then I responded and said, "Well, why don't you start looking at Christ rather than Christians. My dad accepted Christ that night. He got baptized after he was out of the hospital, and he lived for the Lord the rest of his life. I never would have put any money that my dad would come to the Lord. It was not going to happen. And I can bet you to this day, if I would have tried to argue with him, it wouldn't have happened. Ask the question, be quiet. Don't be intimidated. The adversary isn't that strong. Another example. I had a, this is an abortion debate, okay? I had a girl at Spring Arbor College when I worked there. She was a good kid. In fact, she was a good Christian kid. I had hired her to be a resident assistant, a leader of the students. And I knew she fancied herself as a political left. Whatever. I thought, well, it was more cute to me than it was, you know, determination on her part. She knew that I was political right. Well, one day while Jean and I were in my office talking about business, I said, Jean, I'm just curious, abortion, how do you feel about that? Woman's right to choose. I said, okay. First trimester? Yep, woman's right to choose. Okay. Second trimester? Yep, woman's right to choose, Everett. I said, okay. I ask another question. Third trimester? Yep, woman's right to choose. I said, okay. How about tail end of third trimester, Jean? Woman's right to choose. She's being consistent, isn't she? I haven't done anything yet but ask questions. I said, okay, 1 minute before birth, woman's right to choose. I said, okay, Jean, let's say that immediately after birth, 61 seconds later, you find out that the baby that's been born is Phil. You see, Phil was a student on our campus who was a paraplegic. He had multiple sclerosis or maybe cerebral palsy. I can't remember which, but he was all palsied up and he was in a wheelchair. He had very little control of his body. He was a bright kid. He was in college. That was Phil. I said, Gene, first trimester, women's right to choose. Yep. Second? Yep. Third? Yep. 1 minute before? Yep. Okay. 1 second after birth, it's Phil. 61 seconds later than when it was the women's right to choose. What now? You know what she said? Woman's right to choose. I didn't say anything. I didn't have to. She recognized the absurdity of her worldview. That if she was going to carry that priority through to its logical conclusion, that she could terminate children after birth. Because what's the difference between 1 minute before or 1 second after other than location? It's the same individual. It's just the placement of the individual. And she knew it. I didn't have to say anything. So in terms of defending a worldview that values life over an individual's choice, why argue? She set her own trap, and she has to live with the consequences of that, and she knows that that was an absurd argument. Those are a couple situations where I feel I've had success. You know, I had a friend that told me that he got in a debate once on the issue of sexuality. This is a medical doctor that I know out in New York, and he was debating with some people on sexuality, so he said, I'm wondering, how do you feel about sexual standards in general? You're saying that you don't have the right to impose your views on somebody else's private behavior, their bedroom behavior, their sexual choices. No, you don't. You don't have that right. Well, how do you feel about NAMBLA's position? Well, what's NAMBLA's position? Well, the North America Man Love Boy Association has a specific motto, and the motto is, indoctrinate by 8 or too late. Indoctrinate by 8 or too late. In other words, this gay male men's population is advocating sex with boys, and they're saying that you should indoctrinate them by 8 years of age or you'll lose them. How do you feel about that? Should there be a standard against that? And the, again, you can just shut up at that point and let the person try to justify no standards for sexual behavior. And it's indefensible for most people. If that one lost, this guy would refer to a case in court where Peter Kreeft tells a story about a gang rape of a nun, a real situation where a nun was raped by a gang. And my friend would ask the question, was that wrong? Well, again, the absurdity of the situation. Sexual behavior does have boundaries. Even the most liberal in our society would agree that boundaries exist. So by asking logical questions as to where you're going to draw the boundary, and once the person admits that a boundary is to be drawn, then I think you just have to subtly ask the question, well, on what basis did you draw it? Tell me your worldview and why you think that boundary is valid at that point. I would think that then, if the boundary is valid, then you can start using the foundation for the validity of that boundary to build out your worldview on sexuality. I could go into some more, but I won't right now. Do any of you have some examples on some successes that you've had in debating, that's the wrong word, in defending or presenting your worldview? Or do you have some failures you'd like to throw out and ask somebody to help you on responding to it differently? Anything? Yes. Give an example.
Well, I'll just share with you the group example I shared with you earlier. At school, we're involved in a meeting with students, and within the same room, there were several other instructors. I was one. There's another guy whom I got to know who was a Marxist. A couple other people who were atheists. One who was Muslim. These people were geniuses in what they've done in the past. A couple of them actually worked for huge oil companies in Saudi Arabia, et cetera, refining oil reserves, et cetera. So, you know, they knew about a bunch of things. And they got on the discussion of intelligent design versus evolution involved. Well, my Marxist friend looked at me and said, Jim, what do you think? You've got to remember, I kept my mouth shut. Token Christian of the group. Okay? So I'm sucking me right into this discussion. Well, Jim, what do you think? Is it intellectual design or is it Darwinism? You know? And I've been reading some stuff on the topic earlier. And like I said, I'm sucked into this thing because I didn't initiate it, I didn't involve with it. But okay, the challenge is pretty put forth. Jim, what do you think? And I think it surprised him a little bit. Said, you know, there is a definite problem with evolution in that the proponents of evolution have never demonstrated how a species can go from one state to a higher order. And in order to do that, I'm assuming that there needs to be additional knowledge or information inserted into the DNA, enzymes, you know, on the cellular level.
So, and that's what we're saying. I'm like, okay, where is this going to go?
You know, one. I don't know, anybody else? I'm thinking of one thing in this scenario that hey, you know what? You're not going to win the argument today. And you don't need to. Remember what I said? Trust the truth. Trust the value. Do you think that every one of the people that Jesus said, those of you without sin cast the first stone, do you think they all walked away and later converted to followers of Christ? No. If Christ didn't win 100% of the folks over, then you surely won't. Maybe that sounds too defeatist, but I'm sorry, that's realistic. It's just not going to happen. One of the things I'm thinking of while you're telling the story is maybe, I don't know, critique this for me, guys. Maybe take your daughter aside and say, look, we believe that, is it your grandma? Is that who she was debating with? We believe that your grandma was created in the image of God, right? We believe that as Christians that we are responsible for treating people with respect and granting them the dignity that God has given them because they are created by God, right? And then go to your mom. Go to your mother-in-law and say to her, I apologize for my daughter. And maybe even have your daughter say to her, Grandma, it's my responsibility to treat you with respect because I believe you've been created in the image of God. I guess my point there is the power of your worldview shows your mother-in-law a higher level of respect than the power of your mother-in-law's worldview. So if you could point that out somehow in the way you're responding by elevating her and treating her with love, treating her with kindness because you believe in intelligent design, and that sets the standard for a higher level of respect between human beings than otherwise. At some point along the conversation, you may have an opportunity someday to ask your mother-in-law if radical Darwinism is the end of the story, then on what basis do you show respect to human beings over and above any other animal or biology for that matter? Again, it's one of the things that I think, one of the questions I think can be asked at the right time, and this has to be inserted at a point of calmness, not at a point of anger on either party, but a question such as, Are you absolutely and irrefutably right? Do you believe that your position is absolutely and irrefutably right? Now, I can tell you right now that because of our postmodern day, 99.9% of the people you ask that question to are going to say, well, no. Because their postmodern worldview requires them to say no. Because they're not absolutely irrefutably sure of anything, they claim. So I think of one of my brothers. The perfect response to one of my brothers is, Lee, are you absolutely confident that you are irrefutably right? And he can't say yes, because he would catch himself in a trap if he does so. Well, what that does is, okay, if you're not sure, then let's both admit that we can learn something, and let's sit down together and have a discussion looking for what's true. Do you want to do that? Some people will say no. If they do, let them go. They've admitted to you that they don't care about pursuing an answer. And if that's where they stand, then so be it. Some people might actually say, well, yeah, let's sit down and talk, because I'm going to prove to you that you're wrong, is their thinking. And if that's what they're thinking, great, you've got an opportunity now. Another question that can be asked is there a truth beyond your opinion or mine? Do you think there's something that's true beyond my opinion and yours? The heading for these questions I've written down here, and this is another article I wrote once, was, do you really want an answer? Do you really want an answer? So when you get into a debate with somebody or a discussion with somebody, the question in your mind and waiting for the opportunity to ask the question at the appropriate time is, well, do you really want an answer, or do you just want, now you shouldn't say the second part of it, but implicit in the second part is, do you just want to browbeat me with your lousy attitude? Or do you really want to have a discussion? Do you really want an answer? Right.
And asking the right questions can help them come to the conclusions that they haven't really considered yet that they're heading towards. So I was sitting in a gathering with some of my extended family once. This is exactly, wasn't really exactly a question, but it's kind of a statement that stopped the debate. It was with my grandmother, some of my cousins, Laura and I were there, and I had a cousin from my extended family, second cousin, who brought up, somehow the abortion debate came up, and she was on her soapbox about a woman's right to choose. And there came a point in the argument where everybody was sitting there, it was like her and then the 12 of us that all disagreed with her, but nobody was saying anything. And Laura said, you know what? She says, if I see that unborn child as a person, and I see it as murder,
and my guess is you probably didn't win at the time, but if it was presented with grace and compassion, then you planted a seed for the future because your argument is sound. Okay, so there you go. There you go. So another example of a victory. But I can tell you situations where I've been in such similar conversations where that sound logic and that sound argument doesn't prevail at the time. But it's still the right thing to do. And even though you may lose in the face of the ugly nature of our culture, it was still the right thing to do and the truth will win. Let me point out a couple other things and we'll draw it to a close here.
and a lot more, you know, tact. So they managed to salvage what they could, and we ended up befriending these guys. I mean, thanks to them. But I just immediately, my attitude was very offensive and like, well, I know you're wrong, and I'm going to show you that you're wrong, and I don't care what you have to say. And we ended up building a relationship with them, even if it was just a friendship with them.
Probably not, but that's a... One of the things, I'm going to show, there are a couple mistakes I think we make, and then we'll conclude this here. Discussing with your angry adversary, I've said, ask the right question, such as, do you really want an answer? Is your opinion good enough for you, or would you like to discuss something stronger than your opinion? Are you absolutely and irrefutably right? Is there a truth beyond your opinion or beyond mine? Ask those questions at the appropriate time. Don't play by their rules, like I said. They're better at it than you are. Satan is the father of lies, i.e. the author of fallacious thinking. Okay? So don't play within those rules. You will always lose. Therefore, don't use fallacies in your arguments. And we all do. You do it. I've been tempted to do it. Remember your philosophy 101 here. Ad populum. An ad populum fallacy is a fallacy where you refer to the population. In other words, well, everybody knows that. Or all scientists think this. Frankly, your mother-in-law's argument where she says that there's a ton of evidence out there for this. That's a fallacy of ad populum, basically referring to numbers as the equivalent of truth. Well, just because everybody thinks it doesn't make it true. That's a fallacy of ad populum, and you shouldn't use that argument either. Okay? Another one is fallacy of ad hominem. Do you remember what that is? That's an attack of the person. In other words, well, you're an idiot. Okay? And when you come across, well, you just don't have a... Academics do it all the time. The academy does it all the time. It's a fallacy ad hominem because we use our degrees to squelch the debate. Well, I know more because I have this degree. Well, hoo-ah, says who? Just because you have that degree doesn't mean anything necessarily in terms of what's true or not true. Okay, these ad hominem attacks of attacking people by virtue of them being stupid and you being superior or vice versa are fallacious. And you can appropriately point that out at times by referring to the fallacious nature of the thought. Okay, another one that's used all the time is a non sequitur. A non sequitur assumes something. It's an assumption. It connects two things that aren't necessarily valid in connecting them. In other words... well, I go to the Wesleyan Church, therefore, I believe that I'm right. Well, being a member of the Wesleyan Church doesn't make me right. It's a non sequitur. There's a connect there that isn't necessarily valid in my final position. Okay? So, we do it all the time, and you need to be careful not to use those arguments against other people, because even though they may not know the definition of ad populum, ad hominem, and non sequitur, they instinctively know that you're playing dirty pool. Because you can feel it. You know it. Because when it happens against you, you can feel it. You know it. You're thinking, well, that doesn't make sense. That's not fair. You may not be able to identify why at the time, but it's junk. It's junk science. And you know it. You just haven't been able to put your finger on it. So be aware of some of those things. Examples right now where non sequiturs and ad populum and ad hominem are used all the time are back to my two previous examples, and that's intelligent design and global warming. Well, the National Academy of Science X, Y, and Z says that global warming is real. So what? The National Academy of Science X, Y, Z used to say that the Earth was flat. So what? Just because the entire scientific establishment believes in X doesn't mean that the truth might not prove that belief wrong over time. Okay? And the perfect example of that for the left is that up until the 1940s and 50s, everybody believed in creationism. And it was the Darwinists who came to the table and said, well, we should have the freedom to discuss an idea that isn't popularly accepted, but we still believe it's true. So they were arguing against the ad populum. And that's how Darwinism got into the debate. So the left really embraced the challenge of ad populum when it was to their advantage, and now they use it to suppress your view. Okay? So be prepared to point some of those things out at the appropriate time. One last example. I wrote an article in the Examiner Enterprise in Bartlesville, and it was laden with some Christian worldview assumptions. And there was a guy who wrote a contrary letter back to the paper refuting my position. And he was a jerk. I mean, he was a snotty jerk in the way he called me names and challenged my academic credibility and made it sound like I was too stupid to think my way out of a paper bag. Well, it made me mad. I'm thinking, you want to debate, bud? We'll debate. You know, my first reaction was, I'm just going to squash this guy with another letter. Okay? That was my thinking. I calmed myself down. And I thought, no, that's wrong. I do think I could. I think my argument's a lot stronger than his, and I think he's a dope. But it's wrong. I'm not going to act that way. So I did write another article to the paper. I did not even refer to him by name. I did not attack his credibility. I did not attack his credentials. I chose to focus on a couple of his ideas, and I responded to ideas, not to a person. And I never heard from the guy again. He dropped it. He never went after me again. And I know that 17,000 people in Bartlesville that subscribed to the newspaper were watching that debate. Okay? And I know that I could have responded and just squashed, in my opinion, squashed every one of his arguments with a stronger response and made him look like he was clueless. But rather than even acknowledging him as an individual, I responded to ideas. And I responded to them graciously and clearly. And the thing was over. Now, did I win him to Christ? Probably not. Did I scare him away from Christ? I don't think I did. Because he didn't see an angry, red-faced conservative yelling at him. He did not see that. He saw somebody respond to a couple of his ideas, which were dopey. And I pointed out a stronger idea. And that was the end of it. So just be careful on those types of things. You need to... I don't think any of us have to go back to school, but I think all of us need to read a little bit more. Okay? So I'm going to conclude by reading you some quotes to just tempt you to go dig out a few books. Okay? These are quotes from some of the best Christian thinkers of our day. Oz Guinness. On truth. In his book, Time for Truth. It is not simply true for us. It is true for any who seek in order to find. Because truth is true, even if nobody believes it, and falsehood is false, even if everybody believes it. That is why truth does not yield to opinion, fashion, numbers, office, or sincerity. It is simply true, and that is the end of it. It is one of the permanent things. C.S. Lewis, in The Poison of Subjectivism. Unless the measuring rod is independent of the things measured, we can do no measuring. You follow that? C.S. Lewis in Hideous Strength. I suppose there are two views about everything. Ah, two views? There are a dozen views about everything until you know the answer. And then there is never more than one. Gerard Reed, in his book C.S. Lewis Explores Vice and Virtue. This is really good. Amazingly, in today's college, says in universities, many students parrot skeptical professors and declare after 4 years of study that all they've learned is that they know nothing. They say what's truly important is endlessly asking questions and searching, never grasping permanent truths. They're on a journey, they declare, a trip of self-exploration, of self-expression, but they also claim to have no idea where they're bound. They seem to think their minds are like loosely woven fishing nets that move through the water without catching any fish. C.S. Lewis in Pilgrim's Regress. Wanting is better than having. He's making fun of that statement. The misguided pilgrim who wanted but didn't really cherish having. C.S. Lewis in his Confrontation or of the arrogant intellectual in The Great Divorce? For me, there is no such thing as a final answer, the arrogant intellectual says. For me, there is no such thing as a final answer. The free wind of inquiry must always continue to blow through the mind, must it not? To travel is hopefully better than to arrive. Reed, commenting on Lewis's argument in The Abolition of Man. In the Green Book, overtly explained grammar by covertly taught that all values are subjective. Truth is what we feel about things. All truth is subjective, and moral convictions are simply emotions. Again, not agreeing with that. Let me read a couple more here. The outcome of this debate over objective truth is the struggle that shapes our culture. Postmodernists dismiss the objectivity of truth, the objectivity of beauty and goodness, reducing everything to the products of the human mind, arguing that reality is socially constructed. Much like Milton's Satan, they think the mind is its own place and in itself can make a heaven of hell and a hell of heaven. St. Augustine said, God is the maximal being, which is to say that he just maximally is. And then finally, Romans 2:15. Since they show that the requirements of the law are written on their hearts, their consciences also bearing witness, and their thoughts now accusing, not even defending them. That's probably the most powerful thing we've said today. Every human being, created in the image of God, has the requirements of the law written on their hearts. Their consciences will always bear witness to that fact. Their thoughts will accuse them, and their thoughts will never defend them, because God's law is there. That's why Jesus could ask, which of you is without sin? He could rely on their consciences convicting them. Okay? We could talk about so much more. When I come out and do these things, one of my goals is to just get you to care. Another goal is just tempt you with a couple ideas that might work. Another goal is to show that our culture is laden with this stuff, and that if you ignore it, it's like you're swimming in the water and you're just like a fish. You don't know it's there anymore. I hope that you won't fall into those traps as readily as perhaps you have before, and that you just tighten up your awareness a bit and recognize that you do live in a postmodern culture. You do have this stuff going on. But truth is a reality that's grounded in Christ and grounded in Scripture, and you've got the best defense of your worldview of anybody out there. So don't be intimidated and just ask the right questions and use it. Tomorrow I'm going to talk in church about narcissism. We're going to talk about the story of Narcissus. We're going to talk about Carly Simon's song, You're So Vain. I bet you think this song is about you. We're going to talk about Lobo's song, Me and You and a Dog Named Boo, Traveling and Living Off the Land. I'm going to share my own personal testimony with regard to what those songs mean to me, and a story about my family. And then we're going to... I'll get it done in 25, trust me. So that's what we're going to do tomorrow. It ties a lot of this stuff together, okay? So thanks, and Jason, back to you.
I was thinking, too, as you read that last scripture, basically that kind of explains why when people believe something that's fallacious and then you challenge them on it, it's why they get grouchy. Don't you think? Because their heart is the law is written on their heart. Well, and they know. I think they know sometimes, and that's why. I mean,
In my less gracious moments with my older brother that likes to... he's the consummate postmodernist, and he's older than me, and he's smarter than me, and I resent all of that. in my less gracious moments, I've looked at him and I've said, "If everything's relatively, then why are you arguing with me? What difference does it make? Why do you have the energy, or why do you want to waste your time to get angry and argue about it if it's all relative? You shouldn't really even care." Yeah. So yeah, I do believe it's self-evident that Pardon. You really do care if you do about it.
All right, don't feel like you have to rush away. We do have, about 6 o'clock rolls around. We'll start counting how many people are here for our little pizza party with Piper. Like that alliteration. And
Thank you for coming. Appreciate it. Feel free, if you've got questions about the school or just about some of his presentation, I want you to feel free to hang around and visit with him. Thank you.